Prepare for a Gopher football knowledge bomb. This is the FBT podcast with hosts MV and Bull Boy.
Oh, that's pretty damn good. I like it. That's pretty good.
Drive, stroke, bumps. Let's go.
Welcome back, everybody. What's a podcast? I haven't done one of these in a while. Hey, folks, this is MV. I'm your host of the FBT podcast. And with me today is my FBT.com patriot, Elliot Mann. Welcome to the program for the first time.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So kind of a lot of stuff has happened today on Thursday, February 2nd. And a kind of a big thing happened yesterday on February 1st, and that's the subject of the podcast today. We'll talk all things related to National Signing Day and Kale's first full class as the head coach at Minnesota. But first, dare I say it, the happiest day in my Gopher fandom, aside from when Don Lucia won back-to-back national championships, has occurred today, and Joel Mucciari has finally resigned. Finally.
It was kind of a gift to fans, for sure, I think, for sure. I mean, you first had National Signing Day seemed to go well, and then something that everyone's been yelling about for months, years, I would say.
Years.
I mean, in this, you know, I think we knew this would happen eventually, people were saying, but I guess it was... I don't want to dance too much on his grave, but now I think we'll both two-step for a while. But I think it was a good thing.
Well, I mean, it's again, yeah. I've been tap dancing on his grave for years on FBT because I've been made no secret what my opinions of the man are.
Yeah. But,
and this was kind of the worst kept secret in Dinky Town was that he was going to retire at the end of his contract or before Stout or whatever. But yeah, the thing that was always interesting to me was how this was actually going to go down and why it was taking so long. Well, I think the timing of this is really interesting because it happened literally the day after National Signing Day.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes you wonder if for a bit that they didn't want Mucciari's situation to be a distraction for Coach Kill and what would be a celebration of the program, you know, good,
yeah,
however you say it, Fritz, let the good times roll, you know, you don't want to rain on the parade by taking the focus and putting it squarely on Mucciari and focusing on all the negative things he's done. Mm-hmm. I think, but by letting Kill and the football program have their kind of moment in the sun on National Signing Day, and then the very next day saying, okay, and letting it be known that, okay, there's going to be a new sheriff in town. The direction of the athletic department is going to be going vastly different from where it was before, and that we're making this collective decision now. I think it was incredibly important, and I think it was actually really, really smart and strong timing by Kaler. Because, he knows that Mucciari is not a fan favorite. He's not a favorite of the boosters. He's not a favorite of the alumni. He's basically not a favorite of anybody except for, you know, the one or two people that come out in public and will defend him.
Yeah. Well, I thought the way that the Gopher staff handled signing day, I thought was pretty first rate. I think, you know, we were saying that on Twitter. But like you said, the timing was perfect in that if it would have been, say, a week ago, any day within a week, every question Kill would have been answering would have been about a new AD, about Mucciari. The timing was perfect that way, and then it was just, like you said, very symbolic where you can turn the page and then it's a new chapter, I guess, for lack of a better metaphor.
it is a new chapter in Gopher athletics, and I think another really interesting point about Maturi's dismissal, or not dismissal, but basically, read the context and read the body language between Maturi and Kaler today at the press conference.
Yeah.
Maturi, very understandably, very emotional. He's poured his heart and soul into this job for the last decade. Mm-hmm. And then Kaler, he says it's emotional, but he is ice cold. Ice cold about it.
He seemed completely fine. Whereas, yeah, Maturi's voice was cracking, a couple times. He was, really broken up. Where I don't want to say that it was restrained jubilation from Kaler, but it was I think that episode of Seinfeld where George's wife dies and he's come again, and the doctor says, I think it was restrained jubilation. It was almost that. I mean, and with Maturi, first I want to say the good things to get him out of the way. I wanted to at least. To be focused on all sports, even non-revenue ones, which, isn't necessarily a bad thing. And he got TCF Bank built, merged the athletic departments, which was good. He brought Tubby Smith in at a time when, you couldn't give Gopher tickets away, even though that's proven not as good as we had hoped. But you couldn't give away the basketball tickets because Munson wasn't the guy. Brewster was a big time hire he missed on, and you get the idea that Maturi still didn't know what to do with Lucia, and now he won't have to, which at the end of the day is a good thing. I think some of the little things Maturi did, like the Jimmy Williams hiring process or non-hiring process, whatever you want.
Yes.
Or even one little thing that I thought was interesting was on the flight to gauge interest in Brady Hoke. They flew commercial instead of private, and they were spotted, and the media got on it. And scared Hoke off, and then weeks later, obviously, he went to Michigan. And I'm fine with Kill as the coach now, and, with Hoke, I don't know that it would have been that different of a team, but just the process of doing things seemed wrong, or seemed kind of like he was in over his head at that point. I wanted to be really positive about Maturi, but then I just read the article where he's got a golden parachute for $351,000.
Wow, I had not even read that.
It'd come out. That's what he'll be paid for his special assistant job, whatever. Basically, he's open for the rest of the day. But basically, so it's his last. That's what he would have made in his last year as an AD. Which, why wouldn't he get a golden parachute? the king of buyouts. Why wouldn't that?
Yeah.
So that's frustrating, but at the same point, I think it's probably for the best for the athletic department, and ultimately, I think, for the U.
Absolutely. I mean, that's an incredibly ironic situation, the way that he exits in that manner. I will say that I've been obviously a huge critic of Maturi for years, but if Maturi had retired in 2007 versus 2012, people would have a much different opinion of him, including myself, because the dynamics of the job in which he had to do and his job description as athletic director changed dramatically from the time in which he started until the time he ended. I mean, look at what he had to deal with right away. As you said, he had to merge the athletic departments, which was a huge ordeal. He had to bring the athletic department, which was routinely running at seven-figure deficits every single year, up to a balanced budget, and he did that. They were playing in a substandard facility that had no game day atmosphere whatsoever, and you can't give him full credit, but he played a huge role in the private fundraising in order to get TCF Bank Stadium back on, get the Gophers back on campus.
Yeah.
So all of that was orchestrated by 2007. But by that point, the Big Ten Network had just been formed, and just tens of millions of dollars started to become pouring into the Gopher Athletic Department, and then the description fundamentally changed. It was no longer about finding ways in which to claw the Gophers out of financial hell in the athletic department and, you know, and get rid of all these redundancies. It now became, okay, you're sitting on a war chest. You have...
How can you exploit that? How can you get that?
Exactly. How can you exploit the fact that now you went from about a $50 million revenue program to a $70, $75 million a year revenue, you know, revenue grossing athletic department? And the expectations have now changed. You can't just be, you can't just be okay with mediocre revenue sport performances and with a brand new on-campus stadium. Mm-hmm. You can't do that with a $2 million head coach who supposedly you hired because he was a big splash. You can't do that at a, for a hockey team that is one of the biggest names in college hockey. You can't just slide. You can't just let these programs dissolve. You need to maximize things.
And Gopher hockey should never not qualify for the tournament. I mean, that should be a perpetual cash cow. For them to have bad years is embarrassing. Football, it's going to be up and down, and you know that's been a long kind of gradual climb. But the Brewster hire was wrong on so many levels because it was such a crossroad of, okay, Mason's gotten you some results, but now we want to improve on those. We're moving into a new stadium. We're going to take a jump forward. And it was a tremendous backslide looking back.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think anyone is probably a bigger fan of the Tim Brewster hire now than Glenn Mason. Because now he looks, and I think we've talked about this before, but he looks... he looks golden now.
Whereas people love him, and he loves it. He loves it.
Yeah, and going back though, most people have been chanting "Fire Mason" for at least one season, if not a couple. I mean, there were several just backbreaking losses before the Texas Tech game, but Maturi really blew that hire, and I think that will eventually stain, you know, his legacy that he said he didn't care about, which I, you know, was funny because when he talks in third person,
yeah,
and you know, says Joe Maturi isn't worried about Joe Maturi's legacy. Well,
when you talk in third person, you care about your legacy. You have an ego.
Yes.
If you refer to yourself in third person in that manner, so you do care about your legacy. It's the exact opposite intention of what you're trying to project. But let me
ask you this question quick.
Go ahead.
If Tim Brewster got hired as a coordinator, just as a coordinator, wouldn't that even have been shocking of a hire?
Yes, because Brewster had never been a coordinator at any level of football. From the reports that I've read from real football coaches and people in the know over at the Gibson Negurski complex say that his level of X's and O's acumen was just not enough. It just was nowhere near the level that you would expect out of a Big Ten coach. So, but his level of X's and O's acumen was probably on the lower end for what you would call for a coordinator too.
Yeah.
So, it was a monumental reach. I think I remember seeing something back in the day where somebody made the made the statement that if Tim Brewster was extraordinarily successful at Minnesota, that universities and programs all across the country would copy it. They would find a young, energetic recruiter to come into a moribund program that was looking to make the next step and then just recruit their way to success. It didn't happen that way. In fact, I think you can look at any number of examples. Ed Orgeron down at, Ed Orgeron down at Ole Miss.
At least he was an accomplished position coach.
Yeah, he was a position coach, but he was never a coordinator.
No.
Larry Porter at Memphis, he was never a coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
John Embry out in Colorado was never a coordinator, and he didn't have a very successful first year in Colorado. I mean, John Embry is basically the equivalent, the Buffalo's equivalent of
Tim Brewster.
Of Tim Brewster, and that's a horrible situation in and of itself because they have to replace Dan Hawkins, who was by no means a good coach in the least.
But the still has my favorite coach soundbite of the "Go play in the Merles, brother." I love that. I could listen to that all day long. Anyway, I interrupted you. You're talking about the Buffaloes.
Well, actually, I mean, but getting back to Maturi and his role in all of this, it became clear, and it becomes more clear as time passes, that Joel just did not have a plan in place for when he fired Glenn Mason and the timing of which he fired Glenn Mason for what he was going to do with the head coach. Mm-hmm. They wanted to fire Glenn Mason. They made the decision along with he and Bob Brunix. Mm-hmm. Basically, it was Bob Brunix driving the bus with this. He made the decision to fire Glenn Mason after the North Dakota State game in 2006. They had been battling over that contract extension all season. There was a very much a difficult schedule, and they were not having a whole lot of success. They started out 2-6. They started out 2-5, I believe. Mason had started a fight with the fans. He was starting fights with the media. People hated him. He was getting savaged by everybody. And the North Dakota State game was basically the final straw that broke the cat. Cattle.
He was so big and not wanting to schedule it and everything, you know, had that kind of hubris. And then to come up when it was 10-9, and it was and they should have lost by all accounts.
The other thing about the game too was the fans were absolutely embarrassed. They were just completely embarrassed. The players were embarrassed too. I remember seeing comments from Mike Sherrills, who's now a member of the Gopher football staff, that they were embarrassed by the way that they played. That they should never play like that against an FCS team. And this wasn't even just a regular FCS team. That North Dakota State was reclassifying that year.
Yeah. And they were a bad NDSU team then. It wasn't like now where they were, a lower level champion or anything like that. Like you said, they were a lower level team.
Yeah, they were moving from Division II.
Yeah.
So, that was the game that literally decided everything. So Mason was supposed to be fired after that. Because his response to the game was just he came out, trademark grinning Glenn, a loose style, smiling. He says, "You know what? This is one of those games where you just have to smile because you know you should have lost, but you won the game anyway." So and after everything that had happened during his 10-year run, and what had happened during that season, it was the final straw. But the problem was, this was not the first time that Maturi had made the decision to fire somebody, only to back off and do it at the worst possible time. Mm-hmm. If you recall back a year, just earlier that year, Dan Munson was going to be fired at the end of the season.
Mm-hmm. Then they extended him, or I'm trying to remember the exact timeline on that. But yeah, I remember he was going to be out, and then for whatever reason,
because it got leaked to the press beforehand, and they kept him. Felt bad, so they kept him for the year. But they ended up firing him anyway after they lost to Marist.
Mm-hmm.
So it was essentially the same thing. The very same thing happened. Maturi went into that after that game. He knew he had to fire him. They were going to fire him at the end of the offseason. And if you make that decision the second after the regular season ends, then you can actually have a little bit of time. You have a month or so, to rattle everything up, to make a hire, and get all your ducks in a row. But they didn't do that because they started going on this miraculous run in which they had to win 3 games in a row just to get to 6 wins. And mm-hmm. then when they did that, they're like, "Oh, okay, we'll keep them around."
Mm-hmm.
But then what are they? Then they ended up firing after the Texas Tech game, which it just looks. That in and of itself framed the argument that they fired Glenn Mason because he collapsed in a bowl game. Mm-hmm. And the real reason is because they fired him because he was an asshole and they didn't like him.
Well, and also after the NDSU game, then they came out and just got piss pounded by Ohio State, which was number one, I think, at the time. 44-0, I believe.
Yeah, something horrible.
It was an awful chain of events. But it goes back to the point of, yeah, like you said, there was no plan. And that's the biggest thing with getting rid of coaches. It's fine if you want to get rid of a guy. Well, who are you bringing in? Is he going to be any better, or is it going to be worse? What people are calling for Tubby Smith lately, and it's who are they going to bring in then? If there's someone, if people are talking about, well, we're going to bring in Flip, I don't know if that's the best decision. However, that would be even better than what Maturi had when they got rid of Mason. It was almost like that game was done. Like you said, they could fire him now. They did. And then it was kind of like, oh, well, now what do we do? And which, you know, submarine the program for which again, the Gophers program was, you know, mid-tier at that point. It was a fringe bowl team. Just like,
yeah, it was.
Like your blog, like the blog name. But after that, it was completely submarine.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think we've spent quite a bit of time, you know, summarizing the summary of events of Joel Maturi. Needless to say that the last 5 years of his tenure completely demolished, or not, I wouldn't say demolished, but they really do point out of what a, you know, a mixed legacy, you know, a kind of some very good things that were done, but also some very, very damaging things that were done during his tenure. And I joke around that I'm happy about this.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm happy about it because it's long overdue. And I generally don't think that this man has the capability of doing what we need out of an athletic director now. Our athletic department now is at a point where it needs to grow revenue sports and extend that as a brand versus balancing the books, getting the athletic departments merged, building new facilities that, you know, increase campus atmosphere. We're past that point now.
Mm-hmm.
We balanced our athletic department budget, basically. Now we need to grow. But I don't think that he had the capability or the creativity or moxie needed to do that. So happy trails, Joel Maturi. Let's happy focus trail on a new crop of Gopher football recruits.
Well, first off, I wanted to ask you, who do you think will be the biggest contributor in this class overall? Or who do you who do you think will be the biggest contributor just next year? Because some of these guys are going to play, I know, at least at safety. A couple of these guys are going to have to play for the Gophers. So who do you think, you know, who do you think will be the biggest contributor next year and then overall?
Well, I think next year is an easier answer because it's going to be one of the junior college players.
Mm-hmm.
We do not have any sort of – we really didn't have any sort of depth at cornerback or safety last year.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up losing, I think, out of 12 players, we ended up returning 7, but only one of them – or two of them were starters.
Mm-hmm.
So, for their career, for their career, there are only 4 players on the roster that have starting experience in the Big Ten in the secondary, and that is Troy Sotomayor, Brock Vereen, Michael Carter, and James Manuel.
Mm-hmm.
At least two of those guys have really, two of those guys make me nervous for different reasons entirely. So. But we didn't have any depth behind them. And we were at a point last year in which Michael Carter wasn't playing at all. So we were playing Kyle Henderson, Shady Solomon, Christian Lewis, and Johnny Johnson.
Yeah. Chase Aveland was playing safety. He started the Illinois game, right? I believe.
He started a few games down the stretch.
He's 5'9", 185. That's what he's listed at least.
Yeah, and then Christian Lewis was $165 and at 6'2". I mean, Christian Lewis is a cornerback. I mean, he's not at all a Big Ten safety, especially one that's going to be responsible for tackling Monty Ball or any other, you know, gigantic running back that we have in the Big Ten. But so the issue does become we didn't have any numbers, we didn't have any depth, but going into this year. Now, because of these 3 junior college transfers, we have a lot of numbers, and we have some guys that have starting experience, and then we have a lot of people, we have a lot of athletes and a lot of bodies that can that can be plugged in there, and just a matter of competition to see who emerges out of that group, mm-hmm. and then what, and then if we can actually start to build a two deep there. So, you know, a long story short, or you know, wrap up this idea of who's going to play. It's going to be one of the junior college defensive back transfers. One of them is going to emerge and play a lot. I'm intrigued by Brian Boddy. Mm-hmm. I think that for there's just something about him. I don't know how to describe it. He's not. I'm not going to directly compare him to Tyrann Mathieu, but mm-hmm. he seems to have that same kind of lack of fear of contact. He's just not bothered by tight spaces and by, you know, getting bumped when he's returning kicks. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I think he's going to contribute most right away is at kick returner. But I also think he just has this sort of knack and understanding about routes. I mean, he's mm-hmm. apparently a very smart player, very fast, very athletic. Just a matter of where they can put him.
Mm-hmm.
So the other guy that to keep an eye out for is James Gillum. The staff has been raving about him. They talked about, and Kill made mention of this at the press conference, that he believed James Gillum would be a program changer in Northern Illinois. And then when I spoke to Matt Limegrover yesterday, they said that when he was at Gulf Coast Community College last year, that he was playing at about maybe 75% on a bum ankle. And he had a really bad offensive line, and he still rushed for something ridiculous, like 1,200 yards and, mm-hmm. you know, 10, you know, over 10 touchdowns or something. Some, you know, really productive stats. And they feel like he is the complete back. So he could be a guy that potentially comes in and starts right away. It'll all depend on what happens.
The tailback seems open. I mean, you have Kirkwood, you have Cobb, but guys that didn't really emerge last year at all. I like Duan Bennett a lot when he had another back to kind of split time with. And I think this team will miss Bennett, but he wasn't a guy that you could give it to 30 times a game, something like that. And they don't have – no one has really emerged. And so Gillum, it seems like if he has a great spring, he could step right in.
Yeah, I think another guy, he's not a recruit, but I think David Cobb is another player to keep an eye out for. Cobb is an actual running back that Kill recruited, and Cobb was supposed to go to Stanford, but due to the coaching change and kind of the protracted way that Stanford has to do recruiting processes because of their admissions, mm-hmm. he ended up signing late, the week after National Signing Day. But he's a guy that's got, you know, really nice combination of size and speed. And I also think he has the best cutback ability and best vision out of the running backs at all. In fact, there's one or two plays in the Michigan game when during the only real time that he saw action, he made a cut on a defensive end crashing down into the backfield that he saw a second he took the handoff, he knew it, and he immediately scampered and got about 8 yards of what should have been a loss with any one of our running backs. But, you know, that'll be an interesting battle. I think one of the good things, basically in and of itself, the best part about this recruiting class, if I can just talk more broadly about something, is it allows or it affords this program the chance to develop depth at every position. Mm-hmm. And the difference between Ohio State or, well, let's not use them because that's a bad example, but the difference between Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota is that we do not have the depth, mm-hmm. but those programs do. They do not lose. They typically don't lose players unless you're a running back for Iowa.
For Iowa, I was going to say, where they just recruit. I don't know how they have seven guys on campus that can keep. They just keep kind of pulling them out of the cornfields. But no, like you're saying.
Yeah. So they. That's the difference. It's that you can find good players on some of the, you know, not so good Big Ten teams. They're going to have athletes. Just the nature of recruiting and the just nature of college football. I mean, there are good players everywhere. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, it's not about how good your best players are. It's about how bad your worst players are. Yeah. And what the average level of talent and football ability of your average player. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we simply don't have at all. We are young. We do not have depth. We we are ravaged by years of really, you know, poor roster management by Tim Brewster. Mm-hmm. We have really empty classes. The senior class this year for 2012 only has 12 members in it. The sophomore class has 24. I mean, it doesn't really take a mathematician to find out that if most of your roster is underclassmen, you're not going to...
Something's gone wrong, yeah.
If something has gone wrong and that you're not going to be very successful on the field. So I think that this year, it's going to take a big... this recruiting class is going to go a long way to developing depth at every position in the program. And then get it to a point where it's stable. Just getting to roster stability. Mm-hmm. In and of itself is going to be a huge win for Coach Kill. You know, to get to your other question about who I think is going to be the best player from this class or who's going to have the biggest impact down the road, you can go one of two ways about this. You can go with a player who plays the most important position on the field and who was the most highly decorated on the field and mm-hmm. or of the incoming recruits, and who has the most hype out of all of the recruits coming in, with Philip Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could go with a guy that has immense physical tools and has the chance to become a star at the next level if they apply themselves. And that's something I think that you can say about any number of these players, like Andre McDonald is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Jonah Persig is another that could end up being a very good Big Ten player. Isaac Hayes may be my favorite recruit from the entire class because he's just such an animal up front. And mm-hmm. I tend to gravitate towards offensive linemen when I kind of start evaluating or looking at a program to see what kind of athletes they're getting there, about what their future success is like. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I'm so optimistic about where Kill can take this program, is because they have lots of very talented players along the offensive line that they brought in over the last couple of years, and it's just a matter of them developing now.
Mm-hmm. But looking at Piercing, at least, I mean, to be 6'9", and he's only what? Someone had, earlier, I think I'd read he was like 270. I think on the scout page I was looking at said 290. I think he's probably somewhere in the middle of that, if not around 270. I mean, those guys, you would assume redshirt. I'm excited for Nelson's promise, I guess. It was interesting to see him get kind of some late hype at the end. I think was it Tom Lemming really started to like him? That could have been the fact that he was playing in Lemming's All-Star game. But
right.
But for next year, I wanted to talk a little bit about safety. I think is it Jeremy? It's Balthazar.
Jeremy Balthazar, yes.
And I think he'll step in and play safety if, you know, in the spring. I think it's his job to lose. Him and also Antonio Johnson seemed like he's, you know, 6 foot even, 190 pounds. He can run. He projects, I think, as a safety right away. Playing a true freshman at safety makes me somewhat nervous. That's why I kind of like Balthazar coming from a JC, so he's kind of adjusted or more adjusted. But also, I think Andre McDonald will probably play some this year. I don't know. I wanted to ask you about Jamel Harbison. Do you think Harbison will be redshirted? Do you think he'll play some? He seems like a smaller guy that you want to get in space, kind of similar to where they had Marcus Jones last year, even though Jones was, you know, a D-back, but Harbison is a receiver and, you know, running back and a slash type player. Where do you project Harbison? Do you think he'll play some? Do you think they'll keep him on the bench? I think it would just be difficult to keep a playmaker like that on the bench at a year when you may not have Marcus Jones to start the year.
Okay, so I'll address those in order. Safety position, I don't think it matters. I think they're going to go into the spring and maybe fall camp and try him out.
Mm-hmm.
See who fits what they want to do at safety best. If it's Balthazar, that's fantastic. If it's an existing player, even better, because they've been here, you know, in the system for 1.5 years, you know, essentially. So I don't think that matters as much. For me, Baltazar's a guy that has the size to maybe play safety, but I think that his skill set, from what I saw of it, I think works a little bit better at boundary corner. But again, from my discussions with people last night, it's just not. It doesn't matter. They have numbers there. They'll figure it out later. That's where the position they're in. And at receiver, they don't have numbers. They don't have numbers at all. So I kind of interpreted things last night. All the receivers this year, including junior college transfer Isaac Frickte, who apparently is legitimately very fast.
That's what I was going to ask. Is he legit fast?
Well, yes.
Because he always hear 4.344, but he's supposed to be the next white speed receiver. So
he is a legitimate white speed receiver because he has legitimate speed. They're not that's one of the things that I asked about, and apparently it's real. He apparently is very fast and has actually, and from looking at his measure, he's got good height and he's got good bulk. He also spent the summer, believe it or not, at Rochester Community College scrimmaging against Marcus Sherrills, former Gopher cornerback and current Minnesota Viking. And
JM.
Yep.
When I was down there.
Yes. Marcus Sherrills scrimmaged against Frickte all summer long, and apparently Frickte had made a huge, impression, but he didn't start out that way. He had a huge growth curve, a learning curve, in order to go up against a guy who was an NFL caliber, an NFL roster caliber player, and a guy who was a really good Big Ten cornerback in Marcus Sherrills. So he's had seasoning before. He got a little bit of seasoning beforehand. So he's going to play. He's raw with his route running, but he's got legitimate size and speed. The other guys are all absolutely going to play because they are the way that it was described to me from Coach Limegrover. They all have speed. They all have the ability to make plays, and they all add an element that's really not present on the team. So Andre McDonald, for sure going to play. Jamel Harbison is for sure going to play. Harbison is, he's similar to Brandon Green, but I think he's got a little bit bigger, better build than Brandon Green. He's a little bit stockier, but he's going to make those catches over the middle. He's going to play slot and then maybe go outside. He's going to run all the routes. He's going to play tough. He plays physical on film. He's sort of fearless in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
KJ May is a guy that they're really excited about. Excellent, excellent speed. They saw him. They raved about his basketball ability as a point guard at the signing day social.
Mm-hmm.
And that he's just this great athlete, kind of underrated in the sense that he played quarterback as like a 5'11", 190-pound guy, similar, in my opinion, to Troy Stoudemire at the Dallas Skyline. So one of the things that they talked about with KJ May was this year, because of the situation with Marcus Jones, who may or may not be ready, they won't know until they put him through spring drills.
Yeah.
That May in fact be a slot receiver, but they could also move him back to running back, and he could be like kind of a slot back type of player. And the guy that's athletic, it's versatile scheme wise.
Mm-hmm.
That will allow them to disguise what they're trying to do on any given play, depending on what the defense shows. I made the comparison to Coach Limegrover, which he agreed with, and he expanded on a little bit more, that this is very similar to what Boise State does. Mm-hmm. Boise State has backs that can line up both in the backfield and in the slot, or they can go from the slot into the backfield, and that they're equally capable of running routes as they are running up the middle. Mm-hmm. And you can't really tell what they're doing on any given play because they window dress so much. And they actually learn, and Limegrover and the rest of the NIU staff actually learned this when they went out to Boise State about 4 or 5 years ago. And they learned how to sort of disguise plays and their intentions with personnel packages and movements and motions and shifts.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think all the receivers are going to play. They all add elements of playmaking that just we don't necessarily have. Our depth at wide receiver was thin last year and unproven, and it takes an even bigger hit this year without Dejon McKnight or Eric Lair. So they have to you know, they have to add some new players in there. But
how much do you think Moulton will play then this year? I mean, I he was an okay player. I thought he was a guy who, you know, they didn't have a lot, so that he had to play. He made a couple drops that were rough. But I would think he loses a lot of playing time, especially if Fricke can play, if Harbison is ready to go, if his knee is holding, any of Crawford Tufts, who is, you know, who I thought was decent. But, you know, like you said, the guys from last year, Moulton included, didn't have that breakaway speed, or there wasn't a guy where you could get the ball in space and he was going to make moves, which I think they may have.
I actually kind of disagree. I think Moulton had actually showcased some really good speed, and he had some decent playmaking ability. I think his problem was he hit the kind of junior college wall. You remember, he wasn't here for spring practice. He signed late. Mm-hmm. So he got here in the summer and participated in fall camp, and due to any number of different things, the fact that they were really thin in the roster, he kind of had to take on more responsibility than I think the coaches wanted to put on him right away. Mm-hmm. And he was only a sophomore, you know, a sophomore, had very limited experience in camp. And I think that given time to understand what it is that he needs to do and how he needs to prepare himself at the Big Ten level as a junior now, I think he'll get better. He'll be bigger. He'll understand, you know, strength and conditioning a little bit better. He'll know how to pace himself for the length of the Big Ten schedule. So I wouldn't necessarily count out Moulton right away. He definitely has some attributes that the staff is looking for. It's just a matter of him actually doing it. But I will say, though, that those drops, especially against the Northwestern game, which were really egregious, that's something I would say is a concern, and they're going to have to he's personally going to have to work out those hands issues.
Well, and plus with, Marquise Gray, he's not an accurate quarterback, which I don't think I'm, you know, treading any new ground saying that. But at the same point, you know, when he hits his receiver, the Gophers aren't a good enough team where you can drop passes on, you know, third down, things like that at this point. And so that really hurt when Gray was hitting receivers and then you had drops. And even McKnight, you know, he was the best receiver on the team by leaps and bounds. He had a couple drops that were pretty significant, or, you know, drive killers by the same token.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I think that it's just a matter of, I mean, we can get into a whole other discussion about Gray and his accuracy. That's for another podcast entirely. But, that's one of the issues. I mean, we went through a season which we didn't have a whole lot. We didn't have receivers that were reliable enough to catch the ball. They weren't developed enough. We had a quarterback that was kind of learning on the fly, and it was his first year, you know, back at the position. So, you know, it is what it is. I wish that things were a little bit different from last year, but they weren't, and we'll move forward from it. And I think the players and the coaching staff learned what the players are capable of and what they needed to improve upon.
One thing with this coaching staff, at least, that's I guess it makes you optimistic is with player development. Whereas you felt like with the Brewster regime, you had new offense, or you had new defense. You had new offense and defense in many years. And so players were switching positions and really never got a sense of progress, I guess, or never really progressed to that next level. And I'm interested to see how players in Kill's system do that, or what kind of leaps they make. I'll be interested to see, you know, what kind of leaps Marquise Gray makes this year, but also just on the defensive side of the ball with Hageman, to see if he can play defensive tackle every single down, if he's ready to be that type of player. It was nice in the Illini game. They had a couple blocking mistakes. He got in, got a couple sacks. So I think, from like you were saying, with the player development side, it'll be interesting to see how players progress from their first year on a quick schedule to having a year and a half in.
Absolutely. And I think I learned last night that there's a really big shocker in terms of who the player that's exploded the most in Klein's strength and conditioning program is. And it's walk-on John Christensen. This kid, apparently he has completely jacked. Like, if you remember seeing Ryan Wynn about how far he progressed from like a 240-pound high school recruit, and then he bulked up to like a 305-pound, you know, monster, big neck, huge, you know, muscles, all, you know, arms and all that. It's apparently what's happened to John Christensen. And I know that people that I talked to were raving about what a genius the kid is. Apparently he had a 4.0 out of Minnetonka, and he turned down Ivy League offers to come play for the Gophers, and he's just apparently stacked. And that he, the way that it made it, that I heard it was, he will be this our starting center by the end of spring practice. Wow. That he will be number one on the depth chart. So that's a huge surprise. But I think that just, you know, we didn't really see a difference. I don't think we really saw a difference in the development between, in the weight and the strength and conditioning program from, you know, year over year. But mm-hmm. this is, I think, where you might start to see the first signs of it. And then in year three, I think we'll really notice, mm-hmm. you know, whether or not these guys are developing in the off season, and then is developing as football players.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially it'll be nice with some of these linemen that are coming in. You know, your Pierre Sigs, your Isaac Hayes. Isaac Hayes has a great name. We have to say that. I think we're contractually bound to make an Isaac Hayes reference. You have to do it. But it'll be great to see those guys progress after the redshirt year, the freshman year, and hopefully they won't have to get thrown in, you know, the way Tommy Olsen was. And then, you know, he was kind of battling injuries as well. But the offensive line was so thin last year that, you know, I think it kept a lot to keep, what was it, Foster Bush, I believe, to keep him on a redshirt.
Yeah.
And Kill has been really big on him. Do you foresee him coming in to line up and possibly starting, or just kind of being in the mix?
I think he'll definitely be in the mix. One thing that I learned yesterday was that in terms of Jimmy Jerry and Josh Campion and their concussion-related issues, that mm-hmm. Kill is extremely cautious with them returning into play too early. So mm-hmm. if he has the option, and I think last year, I think would serve as good justification for this, that if neither of them need to play, that they don't have, that they shouldn't, that they should just shut them down for the year and then just let them continue, you know, just get 100% clear so that there's no symptoms whatsoever of concussions, let them get cleared by the medical staff and then go into spring practice completely healthy versus a situation that happened with, you know, Brooks Michael, in which he had a concussion issue and that he came back too fast from it, probably had one too many concussions, and now he may have headaches for the rest of his life. That's the thing I think that Kill is most concerned about, is he wants to ensure the safety and, you know, quality of life of his players moving forward. I think that's the thing. He cares about his players legitimately. I mean, it's not a cliche. He mm-hmm. does care about his players more so, number one, than a football comes second. So these guys, you know, if he's going to – I mean, he's going to be cautious about it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want it on his conscience that he sent a player back in too early, and then the kid's going to be affected for the rest of his life about it. Mm-hmm. So, the way that I heard it, similar to the safety position, that they have numbers at offensive line now. Mm-hmm. They have – I mean, they're still young because they're not going to graduate an offensive lineman for 2 years.
But that's amazing to think about that.
On a side note, that is amazing. This is what happens.
One Big Ten team that isn't going to start a senior at the offensive line position.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, this is what happens when you don't, when you take a calculated gamble in 2008 and not sign any offensive lineman with the hopes that under the pretense you signed a whole lot of offensive linemen in 2007. And that you brought in, you know, Matt Carryfell as a transfer that year, and that that would be enough to tide you over. But they just, I mean, between not taking any offensive lineman in 2008, and then in 2009, the only player that ended up signing in 2009 that's still here is Ed Olson, because Josh Campion is now part of the 2011 class.
Mm-hmm.
You have a situation where it's incredibly abnormal that there's no seniors along the offensive line. But on the flip side, that means in 2013, in 2014, if we can get past the Mayans, mm-hmm. We're going to have a very deep, very senior-laden, very experienced offensive line, and that is going to pay huge dividends down the road. That's what I'm really excited for. Mm-hmm. So we have numbers. So whether it's Foster Bush at right tackle, whether it's Jimmy Jerry, whether it's Sean Ferguson, whether it's Zach Epping, you know, the McAvoys, Bjorklund, Tommy Olsen, Bach, John Christensen, Zach Motla, Tommy Olsen, Lankovich, they have numbers. They have guys that can play the position that are starting to get battle-tested. They've gotten up to Big Ten strength, so they don't necessarily have to play Persick or Ben Lauer or even Isaac Hayes, who they didn't rule out would play at center because he's an interior player, but mm-hmm. Ideally they would like to redshirt him.
I would be shocked if Hayes or Persick is not redshirted this year. I mean, I would think that some serious injuries happened. But going back to John Christensen, he's listed 266 pounds last year. How much do you think he's put on? Has he put on 30 pounds?
Reportedly, it's north of that, somewhere like 40 pounds or so. 40 to 50 pounds is what I was told. Those numbers could be somewhat inaccurate because he may have lost a lot of weight, you know, doing some cardio and doing some, you know, losing the baby fat last year. But he apparently is jacked.
Wow, that's amazing.
So look out for that. If I'm wrong, I can't name my sources, but I'll just say that I'm wrong about it. Take full responsibility.
Another guy that you hear names about that I wonder if he'll ever take a snap. Brendan Beal, do you think he is just done, or do you think he will actually end up playing not even meaningful snaps, just snaps?
I would not count on Brendan Beal playing ever.
Ever. Yeah, that's what I think that, which is a sad deal. I
feel horrible for the kid because he's already been through a lot. I mean, he basically missed three seasons at Florida, has to sit out a year here, and then literally a week. It wasn't even that. It was the last practice before they boarded on the plane for USC, on the last play, and he tore his ACL again.
Oh, so, it was the last. I didn't realize it was even the last play.
The last play of the last practice before USC, and he went down. So I wouldn't count him in. I don't think that he's going to be part of. I don't think that he's going to be part of the team. Well, he'll be a part of the team, but I don't think he's going to be a contributor. He may eventually decide to hang it up and graduate, mm-hmm. or he may come back. But I mean, that would be highly improbable, I think.
Yeah,
and
I would be amazed if he ended up coming back.
Yeah,
and playing. I mean, you know, not even in spring practice, but you know, and seeing him playing just a snap, I would be amazed. If he
takes a meaningful snap by his senior year, it would be quite the accomplishment. I think the staff is already making contingency plans. They have one scholarship remaining that they could potentially use to bring in another player. Mm-hmm. They'll make a decision about whether or not they're going to do that or stash it for the 2013 recruiting class. But you know, it's a really bad deal. I mean, and that was the one position at linebacker that they could have used a really big enforcer type, you know, a big physical player, because they are losing Gary Tinsley this year. Mm-hmm. You know, they have to make some decisions there about who they're going to play. Maybe Rouse can slide over and they'll plug in Lamonte at strong side backer. Who knows? I mean, they have numbers there too. That's one of the deeper positions on the team, but they have to, they have some choices to make.
Well, another thing I liked about to go back to the recruiting class this year, it seems like they got a bunch of guys who played different positions for their teams in high school. They got, you know, Max Williams was all over the field, just as an example. But they got guys who are versatile and who also seem, I don't want to say they all seem smart, but that just have a high football IQ, I guess, to use football jargon. Is that something you noticed, or do you think it was fairly normal?
No, I agree with that. They really brought in the number one thing that the staff, I believe, looks for is athleticism. Athleticism and whether or not you fit in with the kind of the culture and the environment that they're trying to bring in here. So I mean, that's it's very important that they seem responsible enough as individuals. They have to be a sound character. They have to really love to work, play football, really get after it on the field and the practice, and know what's expected of them. Can really take coaching, and by take coaching, I mean really get screamed at by Kill. I mean they have to be able to match his intensity in that regard. So, but I agree, there are a lot of players out in this class that seem to be athletically versatile and be able to have the capability of not just playing, of not only playing multiple positions in high school, but they could play multiple positions and project in a number of different spots in college. Mm-hmm. And I think that's almost by design because, you know, Lou Holtz used to have a really interesting recruiting strategy even back when he was here and especially when he was at Notre Dame. He hated, for example, recruiting offensive linemen because he said that if you recruit a guy to play offensive line and it doesn't work out, he can only play offensive line. He can't play any other position, and you've essentially wasted a scholarship. But if you recruit a high school tight end or a high school quarterback, who's typically the most athletic guy in the field, and it doesn't work out at quarterback or a tight end, then you can move the guy to offensive line. You can move him to defensive end. You can move him to linebacker. You know, quarterback, you can move him over to safety, maybe move him over to wide receiver, maybe running back, who knows? And I think that's kind of the same deal with a lot of these recruits. KJ May is a perfect example of this. KJ May played high school quarterback. He could play slot receiver, running back, safety, or cornerback for us, depending on what they want to do with him. Mm-hmm. Antonio Johnson could be end up being running back if they needed him to be. Max Williams could end up anywhere. He could be a tight end. He could be a defensive end. He could be a linebacker. He could be anything. Duke Onyanwu, same thing. He could be an H-back. He could be a defensive end, a linebacker, wide receiver.
Is he likely going to gray shirt?
They're really non-committal about it. I think that they are looking at gray shirting about three players depending on – well, they have to do something. I mean, by my count, they have to gray shirt two of them. So it all depends upon whether they lose any more players through attrition this year, so that they can bring him in for this class. They signed 29 letters of intent, and I believe four of those can be counted back to the 2011 class. So they're at maximum 25 for this year. Mm-hmm. So they can bring them all in, provided they have other roster attrition. It allows them to bring those guys in so they don't go above the 85 scholarship limit.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be a situation where he comes in now, or he could come in during the spring, either or. I personally see him – I have a hunch that there's going to be a couple of players that leave at the end of spring, so he'll probably be part of this class, him or Ben Lauer. I don't know.
Okay.
All right. Do you have any more questions? Because I have kind of one thing that I wanted to ask you, being that you are an old newspaper guy, or have worked for any number of different publications.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of want to talk to you about a situation that happened yesterday with a certain recruit by the name of Cash Money Dinero Mas, Spanish Money, and his tweet, which I in fact did retweet out to all the FBT followers. At MV of DT, he said that he was taking his talents to Iowa, which came as a major shock to everybody that was expecting Dinero Mas to be part of this class.
Mm-hmm.
Those did not include the entire Gopher coaching staff, who apparently had not, where Dinero had not been given a committable offer in months, and that they did not expect him to be part of the class in a long time. This is kind of back in the going back to the deal where Kill talked about how you can't believe everything that's on the internet, and that half of the commitments listed on the internet are fake. I went back during the time that he made that statement about around November, and there were 7 players that didn't end up signing with Minnesota and went elsewhere, either decommitted or the staff pushed them out, or they just ended up going to a JUCO or something else.
Well, the Miami 4.
Miami 4 was one of them. That was down to the Miami 1. Barrington Morris and Denaro Moss didn't end up signing with the Gophers. Dominic Twitty was part of that class, and he ended up dropping. Tyreen Hills was a safety down from Louisiana who committed at random, seemingly. Nobody knew about it. And then he was gone the second that he was committed. So, but with Denaro, what I don't get, as a newspaper guy, how can you base a story and the front page and the lead on National Signing Day with Denaro Moss or Minnesota commit spurns Gophers for Iowa on National Signing Day based off a tweet?
I thought it was pretty sad, I guess. I mean, I'm, you know, a freelancer now for the most part, but even just on my own Twitter, I didn't want to say he was going to Iowa. You know, there should always be a second call, you know, with a situation like this, especially where there was the kid, was it 1 year ago, 2 years ago, said he was going to go to Cal, and then they eventually got back to Cal, and California said, no, we've never recruited this kid.
Yeah, well, this happens all the time.
Yeah, and it's such an easy thing is you make the extra call. I was incredibly disappointed that people didn't, because it wasn't that hard to say, this guy says he's going to Iowa, we don't know yet. It's pretty easy to say he's obviously not going to Minnesota, or, you know, Gophers, this recruit is gone, but to just jump on the bandwagon. And that was, I was kind of disappointed. Looking at Rivals.com and Scout.com, you could look at the sites when the tweet first went up that said he was taking his talents to Iowa, which is yet another reason why people will hate LeBron James forever, that's yes, part of the lexicon. But you could look at those sites, and Iowa had not even offered him. He had no interest there, so I was just going online to see if he'd even visited Iowa. Because usually Rivals and Scout are on top of visits and things like that. You know, there will be a story if someone's coming in for an official. It'll be online somewhere. That wasn't there. Something didn't end up. Even I made a post on Gopher Hole, which is, you know, that's just a message board. And even there I said, I don't know if he's going here. You can't find anything on Iowa's official site. And Iowa was kind of doing a diet version of what Minnesota did on signing day, where they post up the recruit every time they committed and things like that. But I was really disappointed in the Pioneer Press, which is a really good newspaper, that was the headline from National Signing Day, and it was wrong. And it was wrong because of not making that extra call. It just makes you look bad, I think. And in journalism, you only have your word, I guess. You know, that's really all you have. And then when you use it loosely like that, you really lose that credibility. And I don't mean to come off as though I'm holier than thou or anything like that. I've made a lion's share of mistakes. But that just seems so silly, especially when kids every year use Twitter and Facebook to say, oh, I'm going here, and then they go somewhere else. There was a recruit, I think 2 years ago, there was a guy coming to Minnesota, and then he had a best friend that was a highly heralded, I think, running back, something like that. I can't remember the guy's name offhand. And on his Facebook account, he had written, I'm going to follow so-and-so to Minnesota and be a Gopher. And so then everyone...
Yes, that was James Lewis, who ended up going to Ohio State. Yeah. He actually was going to come here, I think, from what I understand about this. But what ended up happening is Jim Tressel kind of got to him a little bit, said, no. You're not going to Minnesota. You know, well, I think that it may have kind of, maybe for whatever reason, they were trying to push him out because they were looking to get a number, you know, fill up room for other commits that they were going to get on National Signing Day. But they ended up losing out on some of them, and they kind of drew him back in the fold, like, no. You know, you're coming back in with us. So, just to add in here, I want to clarify too that I did so on FBT. I made a post saying that Denaro Moss is going to Iowa based off this tweet. So I mean, I don't want to sound – I'm trying to not come off a hypocritical here because I did go off the same information. But then again, I'm not a newspaper guy.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, it's, yeah, you're not the Pioneer Press, I guess. And I did like – I did like the Pioneer Press's headline after that was Minnesota loses a recruit to somewhere in Iowa, which I thought was kind of a funny nod or a way to do it. And it's not the most serious story in the world. But it was disappointing the way I was saying this before. Scout and Rivals then added Iowa to Dinero Moss's list as there being interest, and that, and after the fact, only going on that tweet, which yeah. Then you start to go. Then everyone kind of sits around and goes, "Okay, wait a minute, is he, maybe he is going there?" And that's kind of I thought that was silly because those guys are everywhere on
those guys make money talking to recruits and getting that information. So I think the thing about it is they talk to those kids all the time. They have a rapport with them in terms of being able to call them up or text them or you know, do something where they can call and get the information related to it right away. But what seemingly happened with this was he made the tweet. And then people immediately took him off our board, but they were quick to put him on Iowa's board without anybody really calling him and asking him. And it took the guy over at 24/7 Sports, their Iowa site, to confirm that, yeah, he's going to Ellsworth Community College. But again, what I find interesting about this is kind of along the same lines. It's not that it's anywhere in the same universe of severity, but on the Saturday night before Joe Paterno passed away, there were any number of tweets and stories from official sources of Onward State that were retweeted by the entire Twitter population of America and the world. Then CBSSports.com ran a story off of Onward State's tweet, which is based off erroneous information. And because of that, two people lost their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
The great Adam Jacoby at Black Heart Gold Pants lost his job for that post. And then the editor of Onward State, which is the student newspaper at Penn State, ended up resigning that night because of the information. It ended up being fraudulent.
Yeah, I remember reading his note that he had sent.
Yeah, so it's like almost like a Pontier, you know, type institute type study about, you know, social media and how the sports information in particular world is changing that, you know, especially with recruiting. It's just strange that people, you know, recruits can make their own noise in a sense. You know, it's almost wag the dog. They can make a story out of nothing, and then people will run with it, and then it turns out, oh, well, there's nothing in this whatsoever.
Well, and what's funny is Dinero Moss, how high of a recruit was he on the Gophers board? You know what I mean? Was he a top five? I don't think so. You know, would he have been?
In terms of what the staff thought of him or what the sites thought of them? I think that if it's going by the fan sites, he was fairly highly recruited, but I don't think that he was that high on the Gopher staff's board at all.
Meaning they were really focused on Piercing, Nelson, McDonald, Max Williams, you could even say. But this was the biggest buzz he had, was that he was going to Iowa, but he wasn't. You know what I'm saying? Like, if he would have just said, I'm going to Iowa Community College, that wouldn't have been the headline of that Pioneer Press story, or it wouldn't have been the headline of somewhere else. Like you're saying, you can really kind of make your own noise.
I
want to make sure I don't come off like I'm holier than thou. I mean, I've made my mistakes, and you own up to it, and that kind of and you go from that. And with the Onward State stuff, or the stuff about Paterno, I was away from home, so I only got bits and pieces of it. But that sounded awful. And I don't know what the source was originally from the original source, that he had already passed, but, you felt bad for the college editor who resigned, but, I think he owned it and then some, as far as, you know, what all you can do at that point.
Yeah. I mean, in that sense, I kind of feel bad for, you know, a college student, you know,
I think he showed more class and maybe integrity than a lot of us do by doing that. But, you know, you kind of feel bad where it's, well, if a kid is 19, 20, they're going to make mistakes and they get a chance to learn.
Yeah, I mean, just in the Penn State situation in and of itself. I mean, here you have essentially a living icon and a culture of idolatry in State College that's collapsing in on itself in a span of a few months. And then here you have not just one, but you have two stories of a lifetime as a student as a student journalist. And to basically screw one of them up that bad.
Oh, it'd be awful.
It would be horrible. So that's why I say I feel bad for it. I feel for the kid because he's emotionally invested in this in and of itself. And journalism requires that you sort of be, not that I'm not a journalist in the least, I don't care, I'm a basement blogger. But
are you in your basement actually now?
No, I'm sitting at the living room table.
I should have gone to the basement. I should hook it up in the basement.
Yeah, but as a journalist, you're supposed to be objective and find the story in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost impossible to divorce yourself from when you're at a place where a living icon has fallen from grace, and that 2 months later he's gone, and that's the story. So I mean, it's tough. I really do feel bad for him. I mean, that's not in any way what you would want, how you'd want your journalistic career to go. And then not only that, but as an editor, someone trying to get a job, after that, how are you going to be able to say, well, I was editor of Onward State, and then I had to resign because of the Joe Paterno stuff?
At the same point, I think he handled the error the right way. I mean, if the Boom Goes the Dynamite guy can continue to find work in an industry crumbling on itself, it makes me think that if as long as this guy is hardworking enough, and I apologize for not knowing the Onward State guy's name offhand here, it seems like if he's hardworking enough and things like that, that he handled it correctly, and that I don't think too many people would hold it against him. Maybe they would, I don't know, but I think it's like you said, you hear about it, you kind of feel for the kid because here he is, he's 19, 20, 21 years old. Actually, he could be a grad student, I don't know, but a younger guy in school. And, loving life at a big-time school, and then two huge stories, like you said, story of a lifetime happened twice in a three-month period, and one of them, and get one of them wrong, that'd be awful.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh. Very, very somber way to end the podcast. We were talking about De Niro Mosh tweeting, I'm taking my talents to Iowa. I apologize for going down that road. But.
And then I wanted to bring up one thing. Brett Bielema, you guys got to close the end.
He's
mad at Urban Meyer for the way Urban Meyer was recruiting. Did you get a chance to read what specifically made Bielema mad? And then Bielema had said that he was going to go basically tattle to Barry Alvarez to talk to Delaney.
I'm gonna get okay. Let me just frame this argument the way that I only way that I know how. Bielema is pissed off because he tried and failed to elevate the level of recruiting that he was capable of at Wisconsin by going out and trying to grab nationally recruited high level prospects. And try to take that next step as a program. All of this was a very calculated gamble. Going back to pulling in Russell Wilson when he knew that it could damage the depth of the depth of quarterback and the way in which they do things at Wisconsin. Very calculated gamble, and it backfired. And this isn't the first time that it's backfired. He's going against what Barry Alvarez told him to do, which is to not stray outside of what your program does best on the recruiting trail. Don't go after players that you know that you normally wouldn't get, because if you don't end up getting, you get burned. They got burned last year when they tried to bring in the quarterback Jacoby Brissett from out of Florida, who ended up signing with the Gators. And they didn't take a quarterback last year. And this year, they tried to get all of these nationally high-rated players like J.J. Denman, guy who ended up signing with Rutgers, You know, Kyle Dotson, a guy that eventually ended up going to Ohio State. They try to get Demetrius Cox, I think, you know, another guy that's going to Michigan State. Mm-hmm. They tried. They try to expand what it is they're capable of doing, and they ended up failing miserably. And who is he blaming? He's blaming the new sheriff in town, Urban Meyer, as the big bad guy who stole all of his recruits. You know, how about you wouldn't have to deal with this if you didn't overextend yourself so far on the recruiting trail and then put all of your eggs in one basket, so to speak.
And if he would have stayed in his lane, so to speak, couldn't you imagine that they would have picked up a couple Minnesota kids that they possibly could have had? I mean, usually there's always a couple players that go over. I mean, what was the for a while, what did he call it? He called Minnesota in-state recruiting.
Yeah, he called for years he called it in-state recruiting territory, and I don't think they've signed a prospect out of Minnesota, you know, since – well, they signed one last year, but I think they've signed, like, maybe three players out of Minnesota in the last 5 years.
Which seems so silly in that right now you feel like they could have the choice of, okay, we want to pluck this guy from Minnesota, we want to go here. But like you said, they spread themselves way too thin to get out of their lane. And then, what did they have, like 11 kids, 12 kids they brought in?
Now, yeah, they have the smallest class by far in the Big Ten, and they ended up instead spending a lot of their available scholarships on signing former walk-ons, including Jared Aberderis, who probably should get a scholarship. He was, I think, in line to get a scholarship before Russell Wilson came on board. They brought in Russell Wilson instead of giving Aberderis a scholarship last year. So, you know, it's one of those things that you have to recruit to what your program does. Mm-hmm. And success does lead to better recruiting, but you can't force something to happen on the recruiting trail, mm-hmm, and not expect there to be some risk in it.
It's not PS3, you know? It's not 2012, NCAA 12, where you can just go out and I'm going to establish a pipeline in Florida now. And it seems like they tried to do that, and it's so silly because they've had so much success, you know, lately. They should have, if they didn't lose those couple games, gone to the national championship. I mean, they were set at the start of the year. That team was so strong, and they blew it. And then to kind of double down off of that, to say, well, we took this enormous gamble, and you know, ultimately they did very well, but they didn't go as far as they maybe had hoped. And then to double down on that and say, well, now we're going to recruit nationally, just seems silly.
Well, it's not even just that they recruited nationally. It's that they tried to get a higher ceiling and lower floor of player than they usually got. Mm-hmm. And that's typically what you do when you reach a certain level of success. But they really, really went for it all this year. Mm-hmm. And it just ended up backfiring on them. And now they... You know, Bielema again is crying to Barry, and then he's complaining in the media that Urban Meyer, you know, is this big bad bully on the block. And you know what? Bielema, more than anybody, should understand that if you want to be the cock of the walk, you actually have to prove it. And if you want to compete with Ohio State with recruiting, then you better beat them on the field constantly. And you want to be the best, you got to go after the best, and that's Urban Meyer. So expect the challenge. And I think, given everything that's happened in Madison this year, that, you know, Wisconsin is in for – they're in for some changes over there. I'm not predicting their downfall, but things are about to get a lot more difficult.
Lost how many assistant coaches? I thought that was somewhat telling that everyone left when the coordinator left.
Yeah, I mean, that in and of itself is a big deal. I mean, the two...
I couldn't remember his name, Paul Christ.
Paul Christ and Bob Bosted, their offensive line coach. I mean, those are the mainstays of your program. And now, basically, now Bielema has completely rotated his entire staff. I mean, he doesn't have anybody that's been there since the beginning of his tenure. Mm-hmm. And that he's going to have to be the guy that can prove... Okay, well, I'm a great coach and a great, you know, leader, recruiter, program builder, motivator, whatever, without all these guys. And if you can't do that, then I think what's going to happen is Barry Alvarez is going to pull the plug on it fairly quickly. So
if they come out and have a bad year, do you think he's, I mean, do you think he's on the hot seat already? I mean, do you think there's that internal situation where they're looking at him, which is amazing, thinking, you know, how much success they've had the last few years. But how many mediocre years do you think Bielma has where then they say, okay, this needs to go out, you know? I think he has a while.
I would say he has three mediocre years.
Yeah.
Because when you go – so 2006 was his first year. They had mediocre years in 2007 and 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a really good one in 2000. They started to really go up from 2009 onward.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of their, you know, their cyclical movement upward. And if they're going to be, I mean, if they're going to make a change, it's probably going to happen three, four years down the road. If they get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really see that. I mean, I'm not predicting that. I'm not going to predict the downfall of Wisconsin because I tried to do that in 2008 because everybody apparently hated Bielema.
Yeah.
They apparently still do hate Bielema, but he's won more games than anybody other not named Jim Tressel. So
yeah, I mean, as much as I, as a fan, I want to see the Axe come back. As much as a fan, it pissed me off to watch him celebrate on the field and stuff like that, which I would do if I won the Axe and I was a player and I was in Camp Randall. I would cock off to no end. I think that's the beauty of college football and the beauty of rivalry games. But they had just a great run attack for the last couple years, and it makes you wonder if they, you know, how much turnover can they really have year to year to year and still kind of just churn that out. You wonder if there's not a bad year for them soon, or not a bad year, but almost a somewhat of a backslide. Just because they can't keep it, they've kept going up and kept going up.
Yeah.
But then again, it could be just that I just hate Wisconsin and I'm just frustrated.
No, we definitely hate Wisconsin. I project all of my anger and vitriol towards Wisconsin. I don't care if it seems like I'm bitter. That's what a rivalry is all about. I hate Wisconsin, hate the state, I hate Bielema, hate Alvarez, hate everything about that state to the east, hate everything about that state to the south, too. At least the Iowa guys are funny. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
The Iowa guys are funny. Wisconsin people think way too highly of themselves. And I think that's perfect way to end the podcast.
I would agree. I think that's pretty good.
All right. Well, thanks to Elliot for coming on the EPT podcast here to talk Gopher football recruiting and maturity and Wisconsin sucking. It was great to have you on. We're going to definitely have to have you back on sometime soon.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Take care.
Until next time, folks. Later.